Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. This month, the podcast will be following up on Docket's first webinar of 2024, which was all about assessing children with special educational needs. It's been found that children with special educational needs, or SEN, are 28 times more likely to have a visual problem than their peers. Our guest today also did some testing in their local special schools and found that 80% of pupils had at least one area of atypical visual function. That's why it's vital that optometrists like you and me understand what we can do to make clinical assessments more manageable for SEN children. Later on, we'll hear from Professor Rachel Pilling, a consultant ophthalmologist who also presented the recent Docket webinar.
Don't panic. Don't set yourself unrealistic expectations of what you should know or what you will be able to do. Treat each child and each family as an individual encounter and work with the family.
Rachel will give us more of her top tips for dealing with SEN patients in practice, and she'll answer some of your questions that you sent in during the webinar. First, though, to get an idea of how special educational needs affect children's education, development, and their vision, I spoke to Ellie Hughes. Ellie is an assistant head teacher and sensory impairment lead at Cello Heights Special School in Bradford. Thanks so much for joining us, Ellie.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for inviting me.
So let's start with a simple but a very important question. What does special educational needs actually mean?
Children who have been identified as having a special educational need means that they may require an additional level of support. All children are very different, so every additional need is unique. And depending on the severity of their additional needs will depend on the level of support that they require. Some children may have an additional need but can still access mainstream education, but just requiring some additional support within that setting to access their education. Or they may have quite severe additional needs and require specialist support from a specialist setting, for example, a special school. These children who have special educational needs that require a specialist setting often have something called an education health and care plan. So that's a legal document that outlines children's additional needs and the provision that they require to support and develop their learning and health.
And you actually work in a special needs school. So how does your school create that environment that's tailored for children with special educational needs?
So we are a primary school, so we accept children with lots of different needs. We have many children in school with a variety of different needs, ranging from children with autism, communication difficulties, physical difficulties, quite complex health and medical needs. We have some children with social, emotional and mental health difficulties. Our school is a purpose-built school to meet children's needs. So our entire offer is adapted to meet the needs of children with additional needs.
So how do SEN conditions generally affect vision or how vision is interpreted?
I think as a society, we have got so much better at recognising children that have vision difficulties. Particularly at the school that I work in, children can be identified as having some form of visual impairment if there's any concerns. Those concerns are then passed on to myself, and because I've got such a strong working relationship with the hospital clinic, usually those children are seen quite quickly. We've worked with the university team as well to deliver clinics in school for our children as well, which means that children get seen by specialists within the setting.
So that's really fantastic. So you actually have clinics ongoing in the school so they can be examined in an environment that they're familiar with and they're potentially more comfortable with.
Yeah, and as part of the training that we do at school, we emphasise the fact that we know our children best. We know when their vision is switched on and when we're going to get the best out of their vision. The team come into the classroom to observe the child. They then take the child out and do the individual test with a member of staff. The member of staff speaks through what the child is able to do. And we've just found it works really well for all our children.
So if a parent came in and said they felt that their child might be struggling, From your experience, what are the signs that you think would point to a child struggling, not just because they can't see, but because they're struggling to interpret what they're seeing? So, you know, a broader visual dysfunction rather than just not being able to see.
We look at the whole child quite often. Children may be disengaged with the learning. It could be that they're struggling to move around the classroom. They might be finding it difficult to go up and down the stairs. Those sorts of things are the things that we would look out for.
Yeah, so it's about observing the child, really, isn't it? About seeing how they engage with the tasks in front of them and their environment.
Yeah, and things like at dinner time. If they've got those skills, are they able to hold a spoon or a knife and fork accurately, reach down to the plate and scoop the food and bring it up? Are they missing the mouth? Are they dropping food? As I said, it's a bigger picture because a lot of our children are nonverbal, which is why it's really important within our clinics that we know our children really well, because they can't always tell us if they can't see, if they're struggling with something. We're often that child's voice to be heard.
So they communicate differently, don't they?
Yes, yeah.
So can you think of anything in particular that you've done in your school where you've had to change things in the environment to allow for that special consideration with regards to vision?
So as a school, the last couple of years, we've had a really big focus on our learning environments. And alongside some of the training we've received, we've tried to declutter a lot of our backgrounds, particularly for our children with visual impairments. And actually, I did a small research project within school around displays. And actually what we found was that displays were less likely to be damaged if they had less visual clutter. And this is something that we found had a massive impact, and we've actually rolled this out within our classrooms. So as a whole school policy.
I guess it's almost like a sensory overload, isn't it?
Yes. And that, I think that's what we were finding. A lot of children were just becoming too stimulated visually, and they either couldn't cope with that or they switch the vision off and they don't engage. We pride ourselves on having environments within our school that all children can access. A lot of our staff wear black. I mean, personally, I'm known around school for wearing black. People wear lots of really nice patterned shirts and cardigans. But for some of our children, that's quite distracting. And so sort of decluttering ourselves has definitely helped with people engagement. We have light and sound rooms where children can access personalised interventions. Yeah, we do a lot of things in school to support vision that I'm proud of. And it's working. We can see the impact. Children's vision is switched on. Staff are more aware, which is what we really wanted. We wanted staff to be talking about vision. We want vision to be at the forefront of everybody's mind, because it is really important, and it's how our children access school. And we do have approximately 25% of our pupils that have some form of visual impairment. So it is really important.
Do you have any tips for optometrists in the community that are seeing children in practice with special educational needs?
I definitely recommend looking into things like social stories. I created a social story for our children at school to talk about Vision Clinic, to explain what the Vision Clinic is, who you're going to see, the equipment that you use. A lot of our children particularly find hospitals a little bit difficult. So when they see staff with all this equipment, it can become a little bit daunting. So definitely social stories.
So preparing them in advance, really?
Yes, preparing them for what's going to happen ahead is always useful.
Well, I like the way you phrase that as a social story, because you associate stories with something that's enjoyable, something that's nice and non-threatening. So introducing the concept of an eye test through a story is a really good way of doing it, rather than just telling them what to expect.
Yeah, and children particularly with autism benefit from social stories, because it sort of puts into context what they're going to be doing. They can look at the pictures beforehand, so when they come to have the test, they've seen it before and they've discussed it and they know what's going to happen. They know that somebody's going to shine a torch in their eyes. They know that somebody's going to come up close to their eyes with something that they're going to look in.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Ellie.
No, you're welcome.
You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to optometrists like me and you. That's why we'd like to hear your suggestions for future episodes. So email us. The address is podcast@docket.info, or use LinkedIn to follow and message us here at Docket. There's a link in the podcast description. In the first section of this podcast, Ellie talked about her school's vision clinics, which are led by our next guest, Rachel Pilling. Rachel is a paediatric ophthalmologist and a professor in special needs and learning disability at the University of Bradford. She presented the recent Docket webinar on how to assess CERN patients. We'll explore her top tips in far greater detail, and we'll ask some of your questions that we didn't have time to cover in the webinar. Thanks for joining me, Rachel.
Oh, you're welcome.
Can I start with, when you're actually examining a child, does it matter whether or not they've actually been recognised as having a special educational needs when it comes to the eye examination?
I think from an eye examination point of view, you approach every child as an individual, as you would every adult. Whilst it would be wrong to say it doesn't matter, it would matter an awful lot to the parent and the team around the child, I think it wouldn't change necessarily what it is that I would do. It's often useful to recognise it before the consultation so that you might be able to think about what you might do differently or set up your room a bit differently or be aware, because you sometimes need to be mentally prepared, don't you, for something that's out of the ordinary.
But if you do know in advance, what can you do to prepare yourself for that examination?
I think what I found most useful in my NHS practice is having the opportunity to speak to the parent before and say, what would work for you? What do you think has worked in the past? What do you know about your child in healthcare environments that would be useful for me, the healthcare professional, to know? So that might be they can't be kept waiting. That might be they don't like the lights being turned off. That might be it'll work best if they come with their brother and you can test them first. It might be, oh, they don't speak, so we're going to find different ways of communicating, or that they have a large wheelchair, so we need to make more space in the room. I think knowing in advance means you might be able to have a chat with a parent to find out, and then gives you the best chance of success first time.
And your practice is in hospital practice, but a lot of our listeners are in community practices. And there were quite a lot of questions around doing a GOS eye examination. So in your opinion, is there a minimum that should be done as part of an eye examination for a child in the community to qualify for a GOS eye examination?
A really commonly asked question, Michelle. The first thing just to say out loud is I am an ophthalmologist and I'm not au fait with all GOS rules and regulations. However, success for me is that the child and the family are engaged in a lifelong process of eye assessments in order to pick up treatable eye disease. So that may mean at the first visit, you don't really do very much of your routine optometric assessment. Success may be that the child is engaged, has come in the room and has sat comfortably in the chair and is happy and comfortable there. Whether you can claim a GOS fee for that is really down to the individual's decision making. We know there's this memorandum of understanding which says that as long as you record the reasons why you've not been able to complete the whole assessment and you make arrangements to repeat those another time, it doesn't say how soon that could be. It's the justification for why you've done what you've done. And the most important message that I am trying to get out there is don't refuse to assess a child because you can't complete the examination, because that is actually restricting access for the child. That is not helping us get to our goal of lifelong eye care access. So I can't give you a this is the in and out list. But it's down to the individual to make a self-assessment, really, I suppose, and decide, well, do we do another little bit in a few weeks' time? And together that would make a single assessment. I do appreciate the financial restrictions that you are all under, but that would be the answer I would give.
And I think you mentioned in the webinar as well that one of the things that you think is really important is actually understanding why the parent is concerned as well, why the parent feels an eye examination is needed, because that can help you direct what you do in the examination.
It's absolutely true. I think the thing that's made the biggest difference to my practice is that, is rather than deciding, okay, this child's coming to my clinic and this is what I want to find out, it may not at all align with what the parent's concern or worry is. And if you can address the parent's concern, then the parent will be happy. They're more likely to bring them back another time. I think it will also help you justify what it is that you have done, is if the parent is very worried about a particular aspect of the child's vision and you've been able to assess that aspect but not the rest because the child's lost engagement, well, then that's okay. You just record what you are able to do. But I think it means that what you imagine is a successful eye appointment and what the GOS thinks is a successful eye appointment and what the parent thinks is a successful eye appointment might not be the same thing.
And I think that's why practitioners probably need to refer to their local pathways and their local optical committee for advice, because there is a lot of variation across the regions and there are even separate clinical pathways in some regions as well. So again, that's something that practitioners can go and look up on the internet. And I'll try and post some links on the learning management pages for where they can get extra information. So one of the questions that was asked in the webinar, and I think I know the answer to this already, is if you're unable to conduct a useful visual assessment and you can't necessarily allay that parent's concerns, should that child be referred to the hospital eye service?
We need to think, what is the purpose of the hospital eye service visit? If this is a no particular concerns about the child's vision, it's the parent seeking regular eye care, then actually don't refer that child into the hospital, because the hospital is not going to be able to often do much more than you are. There's plenty of experiential evidence to show that going to a hospital eye clinic is much more stressful for a parent than a high street. The parking is a huge problem, the wait inside the clinic. I think from an optometrist's point of view, talking with the parent and saying, what would make this easier next time? What could we do next time? Testing the child in the waiting room rather than in the test room, coming along when a sibling or a friend is having an eye test. The things that we do with adults with learning disability, this sort of desensitization program, makes a big difference. And that needn't cost the optometrist time if it's being done at the same time as testing another child or a family member.
And I think you just preempted my next question, actually, because judging from the questions from the webinar, practitioners are really keen to hear about the tips that you might be able to give to make the examination a better experience. So you've started already giving me some of the answers. So what can we do before they attend? How would a parent prep the child for this eye examination?
Google's a great place, isn't it? There'll be lots of little videos that you can find that work for the child's understanding and language level. There may just be pictorial ones or cartoons. See Abilities, a charity which I'm trustee, is a declaration, but they've got lots of resources on there. I think the parent will know from their experience of attending dentists, GPs, parents' evenings, soft play, all these experiences of life, what works for their child. I think it's empowering the parent to say that out loud to you as their health professional when you are on home turf and they aren't. The other things that I've learned make one of the biggest differences is engaging the child in an assessment when they don't think they're being assessed. And so if you can have a second pair of eyes in the room, so often the child won't look at the vision test, they're just not looking, they're just not interested. But the minute that you turn away to pick up the next set of vision tests, they're watching you across the room and you know they've seen. If someone else is being a second eye observer and picking that information up, you can then record that and reflect back to the parents that actually we know they're seeing because they're watching me when they don't think they're being tested. Or you can be testing a teddy bear on their lap that is actually not what you're testing at all, but the child thinks that you are, and you can get a little bit of a flash of a ret in the child's eye when you're holding teddy up. And actually, if the parent begins to relax and feel, okay, this is going to be all right, then the child can often relax a bit more and then it all comes.
You mentioned seeability there, and one of the things that I found would be useful was the questionnaire that you could fill in before you actually attended practice about your child, because it was in a really nice layout. And I thought, if a parent actually fills most of that out and provides that to the practice before the child attends, then you really have a good idea as to what is going to help make that eye examination more comfortable. And also you're asking all those questions about the history, so the parent has time to reflect on actually what are my concerns, what do I want to get out of it. So all of those things can be quite important, which they might miss in the stressful situation of an eye examination. So I thought that questionnaire was really useful.
I think you're right. I think some parents, they'll be able to focus during the consultation, and some parents won't. They will be occupied with making sure their child is comfortable and isn't risking themselves or you or the equipment. So yeah, some of it can be done beforehand for you to have a look at and review. Or as a separate thing, so quite a lot of my autistic children who come to clinic, they come to clinic and then I ring the parent the following day and we have a debrief. And I appreciate that within the cost fee that you have, that is not always possible. But actually, a 10-minute consultation followed by a later on a 10-minute phone call can often be far more fruitful than trying to speak to the parent in the room while the child is in there. It's just being flexible and adaptable and thinking, I'm not going to need to do this for every child I ever see for the rest of time, but what could I do that might be a little bit different for this family that will just make their life a bit easier and actually your clinical assessment a bit easier.
So a couple of people actually asked this, how do you manage parents that are very distracting when you're trying to concentrate on the child? So parents might be sort of talking to the child, trying to get them to engage, but actually they're just, you just want them to be quiet.
Want them to zip it. Oh, yes, yes. Absolutely. So my approach has changed over the years, and each optometrist will find the style that works for them. So because I'm quite little and bubbly and chatty and female, it works quite nicely for me to let the mum do their thing and then go, oh, I just wonder if we try this in quiet for a second and we'll just see. Just as a, oh, I wonder if, rather than I know that this is going to make it easier, will you please be quiet? So doing a, oh, I wonder if. And the other thing is acknowledging that the parent has been trying to help and it's misguided kindness.
And it's continuing that theme that we started earlier, isn't it? It's about communicating with the parent. Communicating with both of them is equally important in this consultation.
They are the expert in their child and you are the expert in eye care. And it's combining those two skill sets. Just try different things out and see if they work, and you will be far from feeling that the parent will think, well, she doesn't know what she's doing. Parents of special needs children really respect that. They really respect that you are trying to do something different and you're willing to give something a go and see if it works. It feels wrong, doesn't it? You feel that you are the professional and you should have it all together and be able to know exactly what to do. But special needs parents absolutely value you saying, I don't think what I'm doing is working. So I wonder if we try something else and see if that works. You know, things that in my upbringing would have been seen as rude and the child not doing what they were told, for instance, sitting on the chair wearing the coat with their hood up, if that makes a child feel safe and secure and in control of their world, well, then let them sit on the chair with their hood up. It might not be what you are used to or what you as a professional thinks is respectful or the child looking like they want to be part of the testing. But if it works for the child, then let them do it. It doesn't really affect your ability to do your job. In fact, it does affect your ability to do your job because it helps the child engage because they are feeling safe and secure and in control of their world.
So in doing an eye examination, you are expected to have a look at the fundus. So where a child isn't particularly cooperative, what would you do to try and get a view of the fundus?
So there's a few things that you can try. So always, always examining the parent first. Always, always, always. Because then the parent knows what you're doing and they can then either reassure the child or the child can be watching what you're doing. If there are two parents there, quite often what works nicely is just ignore the child altogether. You're not examining them. This is for mum and dad. Who do you want me to examine first? Oh, examine the other one. And then there are children who go, they don't want to miss out. They want their go. So they're then inviting you into their world. The second thing that works is not having the brightest light you possibly can, is having the dimmest light that they can tolerate. And many children with autism find lights very difficult. I use a spinning light as a fixation device for the child to look at. I know within the special schools, our team use a direct and a 20 diopter lens as a sort of focusing system to get some glimpse. Again, it's reversing. Why are we looking at the fundus? We're looking at the fundus because that's what the GOS says we have to do, which is very important. It is very important. But actually, if you're not expecting there to be an abnormality of the fundus, for instance, if their visual acuity is normal and they've got clear media, in a child, we could ask ourselves, what is it that we think we're going to find that would change what we're doing? Very different in an adult. It's a different conversation. But in a child, is this going to change what I do? So don't keep sticking at it at the expense of losing the child's engagement and them not wanting to come back. Acknowledge we've done most of this today. There's one bit I haven't done, but it wouldn't change what I do. We'll try that again next time, or we'll try it in a different order next time and try and get that. Just record what you've done and why.
Thank you. And also in your lecture, we haven't touched on this yet. You mentioned cerebral visual impairment. Can you explain what that is?
Well, Michelle, we don't have long enough, do we?
That's a summary.
So cerebral visual impairment, it's a term that describes a whole range and patchwork quilt of visual strengths and visual difficulties that children with neurodevelopmental disorders may have. And the headlines really are that this is not just about acuity, and many mainstream children who have CVI will have normal acuity and normal refraction and a completely normal eye examination. We don't have internationally a set of diagnostic criteria yet. So we're all a little bit working out as we go along what we think should be diagnosed as CVI. And sometimes it's their ability to understand where they are in space, to make route maps, to remember routes, to recognize faces, places, spaces. I think from an optometrist's point of view, if the parent continues to say, my child just don't use their vision properly, just say, tell me more. Wait for them to pull out of the bag. What is it exactly that they're noticing that is concerning them? And you may be able to reassure them that the eye examination is normal. But just because the eye health examination is normal does not mean that their child's vision is normal. And I think it's entirely reasonable for you as eye health professionals to say there is a condition whereby the eye is normal, nothing that an optometrist can or should do, but the child has difficulty processing visual information. They can't deal with complexity. It would then be back to the GP to determine where they might refer them next, if at all. There's lots and lots of information out there about CVI. One of the prime websites I would recommend is cviscotland.org. And there's a parent portal into that website. There's lots of videos, there's lots of simulations, there's lots of help sheets.
So you just signposted me to a whole new set of resources that I didn't know exist. So thank you very much.
That's okay.
So what's your take-home message for optometrists? If there was one thing that you wanted to say, what would it be?
Oh, it would be don't panic. It would be don't panic. Don't set yourself unrealistic expectations of what you should know or what you will be able to do. Treat each child and each family as an individual encounter and work with the family. It's a team effort. It's a great big long three-legged race where you all need to work together to work out how you can best help the family and the child. This is not to say that the standard of care you're providing is lower. It's just what you consider as successful or good quality eye care might look different in a special needs child to a typically developed child. And it is a work in progress across that child and then adult's lifetime rather than a single snapshot 18 minutes on a Wednesday afternoon after school.
So work in progress for a lifetime of eye care.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you.
Don't forget that if you head to docket.info and search for sound optometry, you can find additional reading materials and resources for this episode. And by listening to the podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering communication and clinical practice. We'll be back next month to look at the link between allergy and immunology in eye care. So make sure you hit subscribe on your podcast app so you don't miss that. That's all from us. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.